There we are. How do you spell his name?
I-H-R-I-G. His father invented the Irigai process, was director of research at Caterpillar Tractor. Mm-hmm. Very astute guy. Judd was very pleasant, but it wasn't a genius like his father.
Speaking of students, I noticed, if we could just skip back to the...
Don't forget Wendell Willkie. I want to tell you that story.
I have that down. I noticed that you had published a paper with Arthur Frost. Was he a student of yours, or was he...
Oh, he got his PhD with me, yeah. Mm-hmm. He got his PhD with me. He was chairman of his department there at Northwestern. Mm-hmm. And Evelyn and I were in a little hotel in Hong Kong that only had about 30 rooms, but very fine Chinese food. And we were having a breakfast. And it's where the Canadian Flyers used to go. We always went back. We've been there about 13 times. They always welcome us as we're a Chinese family coming home. And we heard about, and so I said, hey, that's Ted Green, the philosopher from Princeton, who went up to Yale later on. And sure, there was Ted and his wife. So we went and had breakfast with them in this little hotel. Got to the elevator, a hand on my shoulder. Doc, what are you doing there? And there was Arthur Frost. So here were three Princetonians at that tiny little hotel. His wife was born in China, was an American, mm-hmm. but a daughter of a missionary, and taught and spoke Chinese very well. Mm-hmm. So that night, the six of us went out while she ordered all the food and so on. And no, I've been very close to it. I visited him. I'm not sure whether he's alive now. I visited him about 4 years ago out in Arizona. He has a lovely place in Sedonia. Mm-hmm. And visited him there. And he's retired now and had a computerized the whole town of Sedonia. That was it. And we were going to Africa to lecture, Evelyn and I, and we, the representative of the South African Leader Exchange, who was going to, met us at Philadelphia a week later, and I was talking with him. I said, well, you haven't been in the United States long, have you? No, he said, this is my first visit. I said, where did you come? Well, he said, strangely enough, I came from Mexico, a little town called Sedonia in Arizona. I said, when were you there? Last Wednesday. I said, I flew out of San Antonio last Wednesday.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a small world. But, well, that gets us... see, that was just a digression. We'll get to Wendell Willkie in just a minute. But
they're all digressions.
You said that by the mid-30s, you were spending more and more time on teaching. Introductory-level teaching and your lecturing. Mm-hmm. One thing I've always been curious about is when Lucky Accidents got started. When did you?
A very interesting way. Very interesting way. I gave 2,840 lectures. Here, I'll show you this. This was 1949.
Mm-hmm. For the UN lectures on the.
As when I was in Hawaii for a year. You see, mm-hmm. I was in Hawaii for a year, and. First, I was senior jazz consultant for the state of New Jersey. Mm-hmm. And when the atom bomb came out, I was writing a book. In fact, in my textbook that I was writing at the time, Hugh Taylor called me and said, Hubert, you can't possibly have published this. I said, well, of course I did. He says, well, it's all top classified material. I said, Hugh, I got it all out of the newspapers. Not one single thing had I had contact, because I was an entirely different branch of the service. Well, Hugh, he said, I can't understand that. and so I'm very interested in atomic energy. Now, I had 2,000 gas officers. Mm-hmm. I had five gas schools, 20,000 people all over the state of New Jersey. See that? Mm-hmm. That's blister gas. Mm-hmm. I gave northern Jersey, in Princeton, in Camden, down at the shore, and anyway, the five places, the 20,000 people came in the stadium in Princeton, it was, and had a pretty girl and assistants came. They went into they put on gas masks, those that were going to risk it, my gas officers did, not the public, and walked into a tent full of chlorine gas to show that they survived. And then this pretty girl put mustard gas here and here, blister gas. And then they were washed it with yellow soap and with ordinary soap. And I said, ordinary soap is this. Did no good. The yellow soap removed it. found that the yellow soap would, if they got, yes, got it on. Well, now the war was over, and I had these 20,000 people who had worked, 2,000 had worked hard, not the 20,000, 2,000 had worked hard with me, and how was it to say goodbye to them? Oh, would I didn't have radio, so I'd appear and thank them. Would I send? I couldn't send. I could send out 2,000 letters, but that was very impersonal. And Smythe had just written his report that very week, and I said, you know what? I think I'm going to do. I'm going to meet all those groups in 5 different places, and tell them all to come out, and I'll tell them the story of the atom bomb, and I'll work up. I did a lot of experiments anyway, and I'll work up an experimental thing. So I gave it in 5. Well, I know as soon as I got home, and I got, oh, every year I get 300 letters asking me to come and talk, you see. And from then on, it was just, and I talked on an average 4 times a week. Mm-hmm. Physically, if you read this, you just see how physically I survived. But it was because I was so desperately trying to tell them how total and complete atomic warfare was. And I know when Uyghur called up, when he was trying to get people bomb shelters, I said, Eugene, I said, the first minute that an atom bomb drops, I hope that I'm going to be killed. Mm. Survival would be so horrible. And so I went everywhere preaching this. I lectured, for example, at Pearl Harbor. I flew 10,000 miles just amongst the islands of Hawaii. I lectured 56 times the last 3 months, everywhere in Hawaii. I lectured to 6,000 GIs for 4 hours. In the hangar that was bombed at Pearl Harbor 7 years later. It was on December the 7th, 1949. It was sort of a memorial service. And they brought these 6,000 GAs into the hangar. See, the unfortunate thing was that when the Japs came in, the boys didn't know what was happening. They were having breakfast. And they rushed out to see what was happening. And they came in and demoed them. Now, if they stayed inside, they wouldn't have been killed, you see. And I gave a talk. I'd given it at many of the armed forces places in Hawaii before this talk. And I gave them a 2-hour talk on atomic energy and why it was different from poison arrows. Mm-hmm. And as I came out, all these brigadier generals were going to be, hey, Doc, why are you talking? Hey, Doc, where will you tell? You haven't told the whole story. I'll bring them back in and I'll give them some more story. So I turned all 6,000, washed them back in again. I started all over again and told them some new stuff. And so I went everywhere lecturing on how completely and total destruction an atom bomb war could be. Nobody would believe me. And I'd say the Russians will have it in 5 years. I wouldn't say it quite that way, as you'll see in a minute. And after Princetonians, 2 classes would come. Old Princetonian medical doctor would come. Doc, he says, if you don't slow down, you won't last 5 years. But now they're all dead. Now their sons come back and say, Doc, if you slow down, you won't last 5 years. I think the sons knew more than the fathers. And the other group would come up and say, Doc, you're an idiot. The Russians won't have it in 5 years. Major Grove says they're a bunch of peasants. It'll take 25 years for them to have it. I said, you didn't listen carefully to what I said. I quoted Condon, Wigner, and, I mean, Condon, who are they? Condon, Ed Condon, the one up at Cornell. Anyway, there are 3. One world, there are none. It was called the one world, the one, I forget what it was. And I said, they calculated the Russians would have it in 5 years. Well, the Russians had it in 4.5 years. Not because of the Germans helping them. I don't think at all. There were so many different ways that things could be done, you know. And so I preached from 1945 to 1958 at the World's Fair in Belgium. I ended it there. I gave it 2,840 times. I'll actually have a count. The other part is about this thick. Mm-hmm. So the whole thing won't be that thick. But in it, I think it would be fun for me to just go back and say, how many times did I lecture in Rochester? Here's Rochester. Well, here's the years. Here's New Haven. Here's the years. So I think it would be fun. And I'll get it all together like that if you want. Oh, that's it. I'll show you that. This is my 80th birthday. I can do it. On my 80th birthday, the office did this for me, which I thought was nice. They took this, and they picked out some, not all, because, as I say, there were 2,800, well, there were over 5,000 by actual count. And they put, where was I in different years at these various places? And it's actually in here. Now. Mm-hmm. It's actually in there.
Oh, you certainly seen the world.
Well, I've been around the world 13 times, and in I think about 80 countries by actual count. But that was until 1958. And by then, they actually knew what it was like. And then I began this other lecture on lucky accidents. Mm-hmm. And it began changing. It was never exactly the same lecture. It changes constantly. And I've given that well over 3,000. So I'm sure it's much more than 5,000. In California, they challenged that I couldn't have given that. There aren't that many in the days of the year. And I pointed out that, and then I listed something like 15 different places where I lectured for the Atomic Energy and the Department of State and UNESCO, and went down the line, all these different people, Fulbright and all, where I'd stay in the place for at least 6 weeks, lecturing six times a day, 6 days a week, and for 40 minutes each, and I consider that 40 minutes of lecture. Mm-hmm. And that's how I added up to over 5,000, you see.
It's quite a pace.
But it wasn't. But there wasn't the urgency that there was the other one. It was almost like missionary work. I just forgot myself that I was wearing out because, and I would have, by the way, I would come back and I had 13 contact hours of teaching in Princeton. Now the professor should have 9 contact hours, so that I was pulling my teaching load in Princeton all the time. But I had given up research pretty much, except for these two that did that research in 54, and there, in that case, and with Arthur Ross and the others. Well, no, Arthur Ross was before that, no. But in that case, I would sit around talking with them, and then I'd fly, and I'd think on the way, and then I'd come back and say, well, now I'll do it this way. Mm-hmm. Then I think again, I'll do it this way. And I'm sure going away and thinking, coming back, I have much better ideas than if I'd just been here all the time trying bad ideas out, you know. Yeah.
How did the other faculty members at Princeton react to your lecture?
There are two things. They were very nice in allowing me to do it, but they thought it was good for Princeton, I think. I shouldn't read that much. There's a letter that they wrote to Dodds from Hawaii. He said it was the best thing that happened to Hawaii. The best lecture they ever had, the best return they ever had to the university from visiting a professor since the history of the university. But the university, Princeton thought it was good. I always remember when I was complimenting Dodds, because I thought so highly of President Dodds. Kept Princeton small, which is, it should be still. it lost its, the minute it got to be over 3,000, it lost something that it had up until then. And maybe it should change, I don't know, but I didn't want it to change. And Dodds held the line when other universities were bludgeoning, increasing 2 or 3 times, he wouldn't do it. And I remember once saying how much he had done for Princeton. He says, yes, Hubert, but we also know how much you've done for Princeton. Oh, it's so good to hear that. Because when you get a salary of $12,000, turn it off, I'll tell you this.
Okay. Why not tell us about Wendell Willkie then? We've been waiting
all right
to hear that story.
This is Wendell Willkie around the class of 40 or so, 41 too. When was the election? 40, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, he was the class of 40. They said that he made a politician out of me and I made a chemist out of him. He wasn't really a chemist. But I was very fond of him. He was very fond of me because he wasn't good at science at all, but I somehow made science understandable and some of the world he appreciated. He came down to the beach and spent a whole week helping putting the ceiling up of that house down to the beach. So I was very close. And I spent overnight in his house a number of times. In fact, I was up at the hospital the night his father died. Mm. Now, the weeks just before, I guess it was after he was nominated, Wendell said that his father, Philip, said that his father got 150 invitations a week and picked two. And one time he picked to come to Princeton to talk. Now, he was to talk to a group of 40 people in a politics course. And he specified he would come only on condition that no one would know he was coming except the members of that class, and Philip and I could come. He said I could come, but Nobody else. So he came, and he sat there in McCosh, sitting in a little room up sitting on the desk, talking to these 40 people. Now, what he was fighting, this was the TVA battle he was fighting. He was fighting exactly what is happening, the government taking over industry. He says, this is not a battle for a building dam down in TVA. It's a battle for government versus ownership of industry. And I remember as we walked back past Nassau Hall late that night, his saying to me, it's a damn lie to say that they can give people cheap electricity with that water power. They can never compete with coal, never. Well, I talked down at Muscle Shoals about 2 years ago, 3 years ago it was, and I found out where the seven states that are furnished electricity by the TVA dam get their electricity from. And you're going to be surprised when I tell you. 5% of it comes from water power. 25% of it comes from coal. All the rest of it comes from nuclear reactors. Isn't that amazing? So Wilkie was right, you see. Mm-hmm. Well, now, anyway, here he sat talking to these people. And I had a great deal in our decision that I'd keep on talking to Princeton. That these 40 people were more important than in McCosh 50, right next door through the wall, Moses, Robert Moses, was lecturing to 550 people in McCosh 50. And he was quietly telling them that this was an invasion of private industry that had made America strong, and the government would take it with a very inefficient management, and this would weaken our country. And this is what he told these young people before they went out into the world. And in the next room, Robert Moses was getting cheers and claps and so on. As I went home and thought about it, I said, think of the difference. They'll go home, those people, and say, gee, he was a good talker. Wasn't that interesting? And they'll do absolutely nothing about it. But these 40 people, these planted seeds in a soil that will grow to giant oaks as they struggle for private industry and the rights of private industry versus government takeover. And it taught me a great deal. I'm sure that had a tremendous amount of decision in I decided to remain on teaching here. So we can't always quite be sure.
What year was that?
That was 1940. And by the way, there were only five of us present in the room when he learned that he was defeated. I don't know why all these things happened to me. That night, Dean Albion, he was dean of the Princeton at the time, Dean Albion, he later was a historian, a naval historian, went up to Harvard and has been up there ever since. But he was a dean, I don't know what he was dean of, but he was dean. Philip and Dean and I were very close together. And Philip said, let's go up and pay our respects to Dad. So we drove up that night to I guess it was the Roosevelt Hotel, I'm not sure. On the ground floor, there were 2,000 Wilkieites cheering. A little further up, there are about 200 people, important people. Still up, there are only 25 people. Governor Dewey and two or three of his people. Claire Booth Luce was there, I remember, and some other people. And on the next floor was a little room, not much bigger than this, or maybe a little bit bigger than this, with a couch on which Mr. and Mrs. Wilkie were sitting, and a television over in a corner. And Philip's brother had just arrived from Louisville, the whiskey incident, and his wife. And Philip said, they're going up to see Dad. Let's us go up and pay our respects. So the five of us went up to, as we entered there, the Cleveland Plain Dealer, Philip had told me that the minute the Cleveland Plain Dealer acknowledges defeat or victory, his father's going along with it. As we walked in, they turned on the television and the Cleveland Plain Dealer acknowledged defeat. And Wilkie buried his face in his hands and said, and his wife was patting him on the back, comforting him, why can't the people understand? Why can't the people understand? Now, half an hour later, he came down to the group of 25, and half an hour later, he came down to the 200, and an hour later, he came down looking wonderfully happy and thanking the 2,000. Turn it off, I want to tell you one other story.
Well, I see it's getting close to one when you have.
Oh, gee, yeah, I do. I have to.
And we've.
Look, I'm perfectly willing to come down to Philadelphia at no cost to you and continue this.
Oh, well, we could. Actually, we could probably continue it next week. I'll be back in town on Thursday.
Well, if you are, that's fine.
Okay?
That's fun.
That might be
not
next.
Saturday.
No, Friday.
That'd be Friday.
Friday afternoon, perhaps?
Could it be Friday morning?
Well, we're seeing Charles Smythe on Friday morning.
Oh, that's good. Oh, that's wonderful. That's wonderful.
And I could just stay all day and come back again, and we can finish up then. Would that be possible?
Do you think Friday won't come until Saturday, Ellen? That's the 30th. Yeah, okay. The point is that our granddaughter and her roommate are going to put all of their stuff in my... I got too many garages, one there and one there, and I have to put them away in that.
Mm-hmm.
You can come.
Okay.
It may only be for 2 hours or something like that, but whenever you want to. Why don't you have Charlie and I come have lunch? We'll have lunch together and then come over here and do it.
Well, we could
That'd
do
be
it.
Nice.
Well, we could
take you down to good time. I was going to take you all. I absolutely intend to take you out to lunch, but then something happened about this guy was going to come up, and I want to be sure that he's going to give me $50,000 this afternoon. So I'm sorry. Maybe I turned down television.
All right, well, let me turn this off.